Okay, so we're going to start. I think in general, we'll take a vote at the end to see what time people want to start. But as I mentioned to a bunch of you, I messed up on the time because some people 7:15, some people 7. What I want to do ideally, not ideally, this is actually what's going to happen. We are going to do this in 45 minutes, which means you are in here at 7, out of here at 7:45, in here at 7:15, out of here at 8, because people have things to do. And even if it means we don't necessarily get to all the sources, the idea here is to give you a sense, okay? We don't have to necessarily do A to Z, but the idea here is to give you a sense. So tonight we have a little bit of an ambitious program, because what we're going to do is we're going to do an intro to biblical criticism, its history. We're going to do a little bit about what happened before biblical criticism in terms of both medieval Jewish thinkers and rabbis in the Talmud, what they had to say about biblical criticism, if anything. And then we're going to start talking about someone very particular, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, who was very instrumental in terms of fighting against biblical criticism. The point of this class is not to share my opinions, is not even necessarily to come to a conclusion in any sense, but only to share with you famous perspectives from Orthodox camps about biblical criticism. To that end, we're really going to be looking at three particular problems and three particular solutions over the next 4 weeks. Okay? So let's just get right into it. Firstly, for those of you whom I don't know, I'm Alana Stein-Hain, the community scholar at Lincoln Square Synagogue. So happy that you're here. And I'll probably send around a piece of paper getting everyone's email address, because what I like to do is I like to send out a synopsis afterwards. Because sometimes, first time you hear something, you may forget to take it down, you may not want to take notes, you may want to just listen. So you'll get a summary afterwards, you know, regardless. Can't promise that the summary is going to have every jot and tittle, but we'll have plenty. But I definitely want people, the other thing is I want people to feel comfortable interjecting. So if you have something that you're thinking about that's relevant, a challenge, a comment, it's relevant to everybody. You know, you're probably not the only one thinking it, and if you are, it's probably a good thing to share with other people because they probably would like to know about it. Okay, and I definitely would like to know about it. So without further ado, let's check this out. I want to give you a brief history of biblical criticism in the modern era. In the modern era, when I say the modern era, what I'm talking about is from the 17th century to, I'm not going to today right now, I'm just going from the 17th century to the mid-19th century. Okay? The way that this works, there are source sheets over there. The way that this works is we can see in very distinct stages the notion of criticism of the Bible sort of growing and snowballing in very, again, very particular elemental stages. The first stage that we see is actually in Thomas Hobbes and Benedict Spinoza in the 17th century. What they start noticing, specifically in the Chumash, what they start noticing is we have a lot of psukim in the Chumash that seem to take a narrator's perspective. For example, the pasuk that I've given you here is after Jacob fights with the angel, we find out that because of his fight with the angel and the subsequent wound that he received, because of that, we don't eat the gid hanasheh, the hindquarters, because he was hurt on the hip socket. It's very interesting. If you look at the pasuk, it says, Al kein lo yochlu Yisrael et gid hanasheh. As a result, the Jewish people, Israel, do not eat the gid hanasheh, the hindquarters. Who is writing that? Who is this third person, omniscient narrator? So they notice things like this, and not just things like this, but other things also. At the end of the Torah, at the end of the Chumash, Moshe dies. Who writes that Moshe dies? Right? There, we will see certain psukim that say, and at that time, this was the case, implying, and at this time, it is no longer the case. When is at this time? Who is writing when? So that's the first thing they notice. There are certain things that almost stick out of the text that look like there's a narrator or someone else at a different time writing them. That's the first thing they notice. So they say, you know what we think this means? We think this means that Moshe wrote down most of the Torah. There are a few things that were added later. Of course, I'm talking about other people's opinions, not my own. 18th century, we move on. As you can imagine, as soon as we already start sort of chipping away at the uniformity of the Torah text, people start noticing other things too. They say, well,
Who brought out Alkanah? Brought out by Hobbes or Spinoza? Or?
Well, they brought out psukim that were like that. I was giving you a particular example.
They
may have taken other psukim. There's another pasuk that we'll see that the Ibn Ezra took that they focused on. But I wanted to give you a whole range of things to think about. In the 18th century, we find that what people are focusing on are doublets. When you have the same story told twice from different perspectives. So the same story may be told twice. For example, if you look in the story of the flood, you will find that the story is told twice. And you sort of wonder, you know, the details seem to be different. In one place, it's 40 days of rain. In another place, the Mabul is described as 150 days of flood. We don't know if that's rain or flood. We're not really sure. And the simplest example is the first and second chapter of Sefer Bereishit of Genesis. We have the creation story in the first chapter. Then we have the creation story again in the second. So they notice, you know, Ki'ilu, as if nobody had noticed this before. They say, well, we're upset by this. And again, I don't want to make light. I want to give everybody their due. But other people had noticed it before, but they hadn't thought of it as problematic. Because they were living in a more critical age, when everything was thought of as more rational and should be based on human principles and what seems to meet the eye and what you would expect, when they see a doubling of something, they think, two authors. It's that simple. So they say, well, there must have been two authors after the time of Moshe. That's the thought. Then we go on, and we see actually, in the early 19th century, the thought is, you know what? Maybe there was an editor who put this whole thing together. Maybe not just two separate accounts cut and pasted, but rather you have one person who's taking the separate accounts and putting it together. And that's what leads finally to Julius Wellhausen, the most famous beginnings of biblical criticism, the documentary hypothesis. And my favorite memory of the documentary hypothesis is I went to Columbia University undergrad, and as you might imagine, when we learned Bible in our literature humanities class, we learned about the documentary hypothesis, and that's the way that Bible was presented. So the first time I learned about the documentary hypothesis, I was 18 years old, and the professor came in and he said, well, let me tell you how the Bible was written. There are four strands. There's the J strand, which is where it says Hashem's name as Yud Ke Vav Ke, and that's supposed to represent the kingdom of Judah. They think that was written in southern Israel. There were two kingdoms, kingdom of Judah, which included the Beit HaMikdash, southern Israel, and the kingdom of Israel, of Yisrael, which included the 10 tribes, which was in northern Israel. So they thought the E strand was written by the north. And what you could see is J and E, J favored the south more, and E favored the north more. And E happened to be usually Elohim. God was written as Elohim usually there. And then he says, and there are two more strands. There's the P, that's the priestly strand, which we know as Sefer Vayikra, but P can be found within the other books as well, where what's being touted is cultic sacrifice and things like that, and ritual. And then lastly, there's the D strand. And the D strand is supposed to be something that is a little bit more abstract, but focuses particularly on idolatry and the problems of idolatry. And he describes this, and I raise my hand very innocently back from yeshiva, and I raise my hand and I say, you don't expect us to believe this, do you? And I didn't mean that in any negative way. He said, no, I don't. I expect you to believe whatever you believe. So I said, great. And then I switched out of the class the next day. But because he wasn't really willing to have a conversation, then I went to the next class where I learned about the documentary hypothesis again, and we had a conversation. But this is something that even in today's universities, this is what is being taught as the norm, right? This is what's being taught as kind of the going currency. And of course, with differences, there are people who later added E. There are people who later added sort of thinking that there was an editor beyond all four of these. But suffice it to say, what this does to the Bible is it says that it wasn't even written, none of it was written in the time of Moshe. That what it was is it was always when the Jewish people were divided, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, what they were trying to do is they were trying to write their history to make them feel like they had an elevated myth of who they were. So it takes it completely from the 17th century, it takes us completely away from Moshe and Mount Sinai, completely away from Revelation, and completely into the hands of people. Now, what is a believing Jew, and when I say believing Jew, a Jew who believes that the Torah is completely from Sinai, supposed to do in response to this? Right? Meaning, do you, and this is a big debate, in these centuries, specifically in the 19th century, this is a big debate, do we engage? Do we actually look at what they have to say in detail and talk back and have arguments about it? Or do we just say, listen, we believe in Torah min hashamayim, we believe that Torah is from heaven, and we're not even going to engage with you? So that was the first conversation to have, which is, are we even at the podium with these people? Right? And that was a conversation that the Jews had always had when they had issues, whether it was with the Karaites, whether it was with the Sadducees. There were always conversations as to whether we should actually have the debate to begin with. But once the debate started, it was very hard to close the doors. And the reason why is because I want to talk about the 19th century milieu for a second. In the 19th century, among Jews in Western Europe, among Jews in Germany, Jews were living in, especially in Berlin, they were living in a culture that valued criticism so much that it was really the backbone of everything. Science was the backbone of everything. Evidence was the backbone of everything. And that really happened with the 19th century rise of the German university. And the Jewish elite scholars, and I'm talking about in Orthodox circles, the Jewish elite scholars said to themselves, you know, just like we always take advantage of the outside culture and try to bring in those positive parts that can help us understand our Torah and become deeper people, maybe we should try that here as well. And at a certain point, they sort of reach a wall because, look at what science is telling us now. And when I say science here, I just mean this critical approach. I don't mean chemistry and biology and things like that, although that is symptomatic. So what you have developing is at the same time as you have the 19th century rise of the German university and all this criticism and people for the first time moving out of the church and into the university and studying things more critically than they had in the past, you have Jews who are doing the same thing. And that we call Wissenschaft des Judentum, which means the science of Judaism. And the science of Judaism, the idea is to look with a critical eye at what we've always seen. In other words, for the first time, we see people writing histories of the Talmud. Not what did Abaye say and what did Rava say, not for the purpose of halacha, but to try to find out what was Rava's worldview, what was Abaye's worldview, what were the academies in Babylonia like, what were the differences between the academies in Babylonia and in Palestine at the time, things that really never before had really interested us in any serious, thorough kind of way. And nobody felt all of that chained to the text. It's almost like they got to this point where they were able to free themselves of the traditions that came with the text and for the first time look at the Gemara without the commentators and say, well, what is the Gemara trying to tell us? Right? And now what happens in the realm of Bible study? Can we do the same thing? Here we have all of these traditions that come along with the Chumash. An eye for an eye really means money, right? Mimachara HaShabbat, we start counting the Omer, we say is the day after the first day of Pesach, not Sunday. Can we really say we're going to take the Bible at face value scientifically, and that's not going to land us in the same camp as the critical Bible scholars? So, that's our quandary. How many people here wouldn't engage at all? Nobody. You'd all engage. Because it's a real challenge and we're very intellectually honest. Part of that, I submit to you, comes from a certain amount of confidence that we're going to come out okay. Right? I'm not sure that everybody had that confidence at that time. They were living in a time when there really was no refuge from this perspective. Here, we live here, we don't even need to talk about this. Right? How many other schools in the country are talking about this? What do we need to talk about it? We believe, that's it. Right? We have a certain amount of confidence, and thank God we do. It means we have, you know, we have a certain amount of insularity, which is not always a bad thing, in my opinion. But I want to show you, before we get to the 19th century and the 20th century, and what Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, who literally found himself in the eye of the Wissenschaft des Judentums storm, what he contributed, I want to show you that the idea of looking critically is not so foreign. And I want to show you two things that have become very famous because there are very few examples of them. Okay? These two things that have become very famous, one is a Gemara in Bava Batra, 15a. If we look at number two. The Gemara on 14 and 15 talks about who wrote which books of the Bible. And when they get to Yehoshua, when they get to Joshua, they say as follows. Yehoshua katav sifro. Joshua wrote the book of Joshua. Ushmona psukim shebatorah. And he also wrote the last eight verses of the Chumash. What are the last eight verses of the Chumash? Moshe dies, and the ensuing praise of Moshe. Tanya kimanda amar shmona psukim shebatorah Yehoshua ketavan. We have Tanaitic sources that support this. Tanaitic sources mean sources that come from the first and second century, very early. Ditani, as we learn, Vayamat Sham Moshe Eved Hashem. And Moshe, the servant of God, died there. Efshar Moshe Mate Vekatav Vayamat Sham Moshe. Is it possible that Moshe had already died and then wrote those words? Ella, rather Ad Kan Katav Moshe. Rather, it must be that Moshe only wrote up until this point. Mikan ve'elach katav Yehoshua. And from here on in, Yehoshua wrote those eight psukim and his book. Divrei Rabbi Yochanan. That's one opinion. Ve'amri la Rabbi Nechemya. Other people say it was Rabbi Nechemya's opinion. Amar lo Rabbi Shimon. The answer comes swiftly from Rabbi Shimon. Efshar sefer Torah chaser otachat. Is it possible to conceive that you might have a Torah scroll that is missing even a letter? Uktiv, God says to Moshe, Lakoach et Sefer HaTorah Hazeh. Take this Sefer Torah, God says to Moshe, in Devarim 31, take this Sefer Torah and put it away. Why would God call it a Sefer Torah if it's not complete? Ella, rather, what do I think happened? Ad Kana Kadosh Baruch Hu Omer. Until those last eight psukim, God spoke. Umoshe Omer Vakotev, and Moshe would speak, repeat it, and then write it down. Mikan ve'elach, but from here on in, these last eight psukim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer, Umoshe Kotev Bidema. God would say it, and Moshe would write it either in his tears or while crying. In other words, this brings up a very important point. When you look at the pshat of the Torah, you look at the plain meaning of the text, how could it be that Moshe wrote those last eight psukim? And here you see an argument ensues. Rabbi Shimon doesn't say to Rabbi Yochanan, you are a heretic. He says, don't be so quick to make assumptions. It's possible that Moshe wrote it, but it's different. It was a prophecy that he was writing. He wasn't recording what had happened, as he had for the rest of the Torah. He was writing what would happen based on what God said, and perhaps he didn't even speak it aloud because he was so frightened by it himself. It's just a very interesting source. Now, you will not find many other Gemaras like this. It's not like every time the rabbis saw something in the Torah where they said, this text seems like, that they jumped to conclusions. But this is a very fascinating source that a lot of people like to quote. The other is that we're going to skip about a millennium to Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, right? Ibn Ezra, he was a commentator on the Torah in the Middle Ages, and what he tried to do is he tried to bring out the plain meaning of the text. This is something that is very often quoted. Two things that he says. One is, and this gets to the pasuk that Marvin was asking about, which psukim did Hobbes and Spinoza mention? If you look at number three, Bereishit, Genesis 12:6, Vayavur Avraham Ba'aretz, Abraham walked through the land of Israel, Ad Mekom Shechem, until Shechem, Ad Elon Moreh, until that place, Elon Moreh, V'haKna'ani Az Ba'aretz. And the Canaanites back then, as were in the land. As opposed to now? So if Moshe wrote this, were the Canaanites in the land at the time of Moshe? Had to be, right? The Canaanites were in the land at the time of Moshe. So why is he writing, and the Canaanites were in the land, as though they're not anymore? That's a little bit strange. Of course, you could easily answer it and say already. They were already in the land, for sure. But look at what Ibn Ezra says. It's very fascinating. Okay? Yitachin, it would seem, She'eretz Kina'an, Tfasa Kina'an, Miyad Acher. It would seem that the Canaanites must have taken Canaan from someone else. What the Ibn Ezra is just trying to do is he's just trying to say, yeah, Haknani az ba'aretz. In other words, at that time, they had taken the land from someone else. Right? Meaning it's very easy to read the Ibn Ezra in a very traditional way. And that's exactly what you were thinking, right? But even trying to read him controversially, why bother? In other words, he's trying to say, Haknani az ba'aretz. It was at that moment that they picked up the land. So that's why it says az. But then he says something interesting. He says, Ve'im einenu kein, and if that's not true, if that's not the reason, if that's not what az means, yesh lo sod, then what we're looking at here is there is a secret. V'hamaskil yidom, and someone who's wise will keep quiet. Wow. Lest you think that that was an accident or a scribal error, we find out later, at the beginning of the book of Devarim, when Moshe is about to give his big speech, his 30-day speech before he dies, we find out that where he's standing is a place that is, if you look in the next bullet, Achadasar Yom Mechorev. It's 11 days journey from Chorev, Derech Har Seir. If you were walking on the way to Har Seir, to the mountain of Seir, Ad Kadesh Barnea, until you get to Kadesh Barnea. And what the Ibn Ezra seems to say on that pasuk is he seems to say that he thinks this adding a sort of a map, almost a cartographer's perspective, let me tell you where Moshe was standing, that implies sort of someone outside of the text. And look at what he says. Ve'im tavin sod hashneimasar. And if you understand the secret of the 12 instances, gam vayichtov Moshe, also the example where we see that Moshe wrote the Torah, Hakna'ani az ba'aretz, the Canaanites were then in the land, Bahar Hashem Yera'eh, which is at the end of Akedat Yitzchak, at the end of the binding of Isaac, Avraham calls the mountain Hashem Yera'eh, God will see, and the end of the pasuk is Asher Ye'amer Hayom, about which it is said today, Bahar Hashem Yera'eh, on the mountain of God they shall be seen. About which it is said today, when's today, what are we talking about? Right? So he says, this is another instance, Takir Ha'emet, you will see the truth. Now this is incredibly controversial. You notice he's trying to keep it under wraps, but there's something that the Ibn Ezra is noticing. That's all we're going to say. But that really doesn't help me if I'm living in the 19th century. It really doesn't help me.
Was he pilloried for it?
So the question of whether people really understood what he was saying, given that he didn't really say it, the question of whether people reinterpreted what he said, there were plenty of people who reinterpreted what he said, and they said, oh, what he means is this, what he means is that. But today it is rather accepted by people that he meant what he said, and he thought he was going to be pilloried for it, so he was very careful about the way in which he said it. And not only that, he didn't want it to lead to mass heresy. In other words, he was comfortable saying, I see what I see in the psukim, but he was very uncomfortable sharing that realization too broadly with people, too openly with people. And I think that's an important thing to think about. Yes.
A few hundred years ago, the Sofnat Ba'anayah write very clearly what he meant, what we take it to mean today, albeit from a different chapter, but nonetheless by a different author.
Correct. So we have, this is great because I actually was reading in an article by a Rosh Yeshiva recently in Israel, who was talking about how the Tzafnat Paneach, he said, we think that the Ibn Ezra really was saying what you think he's saying, and he says, why does it matter? In other words, as long as you assume that the person who wrote this line was a Navi, right? Which is a fascinating concept, and you'd have to assume that when you're talking about the Ibn Ezra, he at least was thinking that. In other words, he didn't think any Joe Schmo came and wrote it. He thought it was someone, Alpi Nivuah, who put it in. How could you just put it in? But he still was pilloried for it nonetheless, right? And it still wasn't a popular reading of the Ibn Ezra, even though it seems to be what the Ibn Ezra is saying, right? And people nowadays are very comfortable saying that that is what he is saying, okay? So you have those two things, but still that doesn't answer the bigger question. What I have against me is Great, so I'm walking up with this Ibn Ezra and saying maybe there are a few psukim here and there that a Navi added later. That's not even a popular thing to say. Maybe Yoshua wrote the last eight psukim of the Torah. Again, even in the Gemara, that's already disputed. And you're coming against me with saying, oh, by the way, this whole parsha was written by this person in the 7th century before the Common Era, not at Har Sinai at all. Right? That we're not exactly talking about the same thing. So even if we have certain things, and that's, it's very important to me to share that we really do have in our history people who have not always agreed with everything that the Rambam takes for granted. The Rambam says you have to believe that every word that's in the Chumash was what was said at Har Sinai. There are Rishonim, there are commentators in his own day and age who disagree, like the Ibn Ezra, who says that there is a Navi who added certain little, very limited things. But the Nevuah element is very important. So when I'm coming to talk about biblical criticism, I'm not coming to say we don't have any biblical criticism of our own, but it's with reverence. It's with a certain perspective and system framework in mind. And the framework in the German university is out the window. Okay, because the framework was the church, out the window. Thank you, Martin Luther, right? His Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, basically that plus the Enlightenment led to get rid of the framework and just look at the text and see what you figure out. Which is became very fruitful, as you're going to see what people came up with. I mean, it was just beautiful material that people came up with to try to fight this challenge. It really made them think. It made them say, okay, maybe we have to rethink this. Maybe we have to figure out how to read this in a profound 19th century way. Okay, so let's start with Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. Just to know a little bit of his background, I'm going to give you a little more on this Wissenschaft, Science of Judaism. Paul, you have a question? Okay. Just a little bit more here. At the time, Rabbi Hoffman is living in Berlin. He didn't start out in Berlin, but he made his way there because that was sort of the center of Jewish intellectual thought. If you wanted to be Orthodox and modern, that's where you went. And when he gets there, he becomes affiliated with a seminary there, right, with a yeshiva there that had been started by a Rabbi Azriel Hildesheimer. So the Hildesheimer yeshiva was started in the 1870s. And the reason why it was started, ostensibly, is because of another yeshiva that came before it. And that was the Breslau Rabbinical Seminary. The Breslau Rabbinical Seminary was affiliated with Rabbi Abraham Geiger, Zacharia Frankel, people who would become very important personalities in Reform and Conservative Judaism. And in response to that, Rabbi Hildesheimer said, well, we're going to make a strictly Orthodox combination of Wissenschaft, of science, and Torah. So anyone who went to his smicha program had to have gone to the gymnasium. Anyone who went to his smicha program had to have had a secular education in addition to getting what they were going to get from his seminary. In addition, his seminary included, when they studied Gemara, they didn't just study for the halacha, and they didn't just do pill-pull. In other words, they didn't just do methodology of comparing different sugyot, different sections of Gemara, but they actually were also interested in historical elements and historical perspectives. So Rav Hoffman, he comes out as this sort of Renaissance man. He's got it all. And he has the tool in his tool belt. He has the tools to deal, he believes, with the Bible critics. He's going to use his science, and he's going to use his traditional Torah knowledge. Okay? That's our intro to Rabbi Hoffman. As you can see, he's a very serious-looking fellow on page 2. And we have about 19 minutes in which to show where he's coming from. Okay? Who's excited to meet Rabbi Hoffman? I'm pretty excited. He's a special man. He did a lot, right? How many people here have heard the name Rabbi David Tzvi Hoffman before? How many people have never? Oh, so this is very exciting. Very pivotal figure, okay? First of all, you should know, what Rabbi Hoffman does primarily is he learns halacha, primarily. His business is not the business specifically of interpreting Torah. He's not a commentator on the Chumash, per se. He deals with commentary on the Chumash because he thinks it's necessary. That's why he does it. But most of what he does is he writes tshuvot, he writes responsa, famous responsa called Melamed Lehoil, teaching in order to be effective. He writes responsa that relate to his time. He writes an annotated version of Midrash Halacha, the rabbinic perspective on Sefer Shemot, and the way the rabbis learned law from the Chumash in Sefer Shemot. And even in his commentary to Torah, he specifically focuses on halachic passages in the Torah. What he cares about is not the narrative portions, where we don't necessarily have to stick to what our sages said, but he cares about the halachic portions, where interpretation of the Chumash is going to mean the difference between keeping halacha and not keeping halacha. And that's what he cares about. So I want to show you his introduction to his perush, his commentary on Sefer Vayikra, in number 6. He's an intellectually honest person, and he says, Ani mode beratzon, I willingly admit, she'al pi ikare emunati, that based on the fundamentals of my faith, lo uchal lahagia lemaskana acheret, I cannot reach any other conclusion other than, me'asher ha'torah bichtav, nimsira liyadenu al yedei Moshe Rabbeinu. I cannot come to any other conclusion other than saying that Moshe is the one who gave us our Torah that is written. Ach me'idach, but on the other hand, b'ma'amatzai lehochiach et ha'ikarim ha'ele, in my strivings to prove that this is true, b'derech mada'it, in a scientific way, hishtadalti tamid, I have always tried lihishtamesh b'nimukim sheka'ele, I have always tried to use methods that will be asher gam hatzad shekineged tzarich lehodot behem, that can be accepted by anyone. In other words, he admits, I'm trying to prove something that is a theological belief of mine, but I'm doing it using the scientific method. I'm doing it so that even someone who reads the Torah just for its plain meaning will have to admit that I have a point. Even someone who doesn't care what the Talmud says will have to admit that, hey, you're giving me pause for thought. He recognizes that in his age, it's not good enough to say, listen, I believe the Torah is from Hashem, and I don't need to engage with you. For some reason, at that time, he felt that the community needed him to stand up and say, I'm going to use your own tools against you. So let's see an example. Okay? We're going to skip to page 3. Yes, sir.
His concern was primarily with halacha. Yet some of this concern about who did or did not write the Torah is mostly coming from narrative elements. So therefore, he's concerned with proving or explicating the halachic element in the Torah. But I think some of the thrust of the biblical criticism is in these contradictions in the narrative element, which you say he did not seem to be primarily concerned with.
It seems to be, that's a great question. It seems to be, and this is as opposed to other people who we're going to see. Next week, we're going to look at someone who focuses specifically on the narrative elements. Okay? It seems to be that for him, if he can prove that the halachic elements that you see in the Torah are consistent with how the rabbis interpret, that the plain meaning can really be interpreted the way the rabbis say that it should be, then he thinks the narrative things we don't really care about. In other words, once you can see that the Mesorah, that the tradition is true and correct, then he need not prove, well, this narrative, because then it's a matter of what you assume, right? Then he's willing to say, well, just like they were right about kosher laws, okay, so they tell us that the narrative comes from God, comes from Moshe, I'm willing to believe them too. The tougher thing is to say an eye for an eye really means money. Right? And that was something that had been plaguing the Jewish people ever since the biblical literalists from the first century had gotten to them. Right? First century before the Common Era. That had always plagued. And now he finds himself again engaged in those same polemics. It's a good question. I think he thinks one solves the other. Yes?
But by 1900, wasn't already one of the big, big stumbling blocks or one of the powerful arguments of the critics, the whole Sefer Vayikra, being so different than everything else?
Right, so what we said actually right before you came in, we said that Wellhausen, his documentary hypothesis, was sort of became sort of the pinnacle of the beginnings. Right? But it seems to be, and I will say that in 1903, Rav David Zvi Hoffman did write a book specifically against Wellhausen's documentary hypothesis. So at a certain point, he did take it on head on. He wrote it in German in 1903 and then published it again shortly before his death. But at the beginning of his career, what he spent most of his time doing, he spent most of his time working on the halakhic elements.
No, what I'm saying is, but he practiced all halakha, or 99% of halakha.
Oh, in other words, you're saying so even in documentary hypothesis.
If he could break the P, he's really breaking a lot.
Yeah, but the truth is, he's not going to break down P in the sense that he's going to be able to prove when it was written. The way he's going to break down P is he's going to say, what's written in P, the rabbis already understood, and even you have to admit that they had a keen understanding of what was going on here. Right? So I agree with you, in principle, that's the way he was doing it, but he's not trying to prove anything historic. And in that sense, Marvin has a great point, which is, he's not really engaging on the historic front, because guess what? The people who propounded the documentary hypothesis, they don't have any evidence either. It's all speculation. All this stuff is speculation. It's looking and saying, this strand seems to be more pro the kingdom of Judah, so it must have been that. We don't have any manuscripts. We don't have any proof. There's no proof. So it's all speculation. So he says, well, let's speculate, and let me prove not something about the history, but something about the way that our progenitors, the people who gave us our Torah that we have today, what they thought it meant. And maybe that'll give you pause for thought. Okay, so that's an important methodological point. So I want to show you. I want to show you not eating milk and meat. That's what I want to show you. Can you think of something more exciting to think about at 8:10 on a Monday night than not eating milk and meat together? Right? No. And you know what? It's going to get that much more interesting because we have three times in the Torah. Okay, everybody's with me so far, right? We get what Hoffman's trying to do. We understand that he's fighting. He's putting his finger in a dam that's got so many cracks and so many holes. I mean, what is supposed to happen here? And he's really working very much alone, I have to add. And not only that, but a lot of his Jewish contemporaries are working against him. Because at this point already, documentary hypothesis is starting to take root within the Reform community. Okay? So, he is going to look at the following three instances. We find this very famous pasuk, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Lo tivashel gidi b'chalev imo. Says it three times in the Torah. Twice in the book of Shemot. And then it says it again in the book of Devarim. Let's talk about context for a second. Okay? Let's pan out. In the book of Shemot, it comes up twice. In chapter 24, and then in chapter, 23, and then in chapter 34. If you look at those two, the whole context seems very, almost identical. The psukim, the verses, are almost identical. Both of them are talking about giving a korban, giving a sacrifice, when people are going up for the three festivals. When they're going to, in that case, the Mishkan, ultimately the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. It seems to me, just to throw this in at the side, and if it goes around you, don't worry about it. And if not, hopefully it's making an important point. It seems to me that what happens in the book of Shemot is that when the golden calf takes place, it's almost like the story comes to a grinding halt. Golden calf has to be taken care of, the people have to be punished, and then we go back exactly to the story where we left off. Which is why I think chapter 34 is identical almost at the end to chapter 23. Because after chapter 23, we find out basically the way that people behaved at Sinai. We find out a little bit about creating the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Then we find out about the Egel. And then we literally go back to talk about chapter 23 again, and then find out about the Mishkan again. You have a real doubling. If you want to give the Bible critics something to talk about, you have a real doubling. So I submit to you that when it says it twice in Shemot, it really only says it once. Because it's just taking the story up again. But either way. Then in Devarim, not having nothing to do with going on a pilgrimage, having nothing to do with Korbanot, having only to do with the kosher laws. In 14, chapter 14 of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, is all about this is kosher, this is not. Split hooves, choose its cud. This kind of fish, fins and scales. These kinds of birds, here's a list. And at the end, it says, and by the way, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. That seems to say, don't eat it, right? That's very clear. But when we're talking about a korban, and then suddenly we say this, what does this mean, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk? So the rabbis say that because the Torah says three times, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, meaning a little goat in its mother's milk. They say it means three things. All of these things have to do with eating meat, not chicken, meat and milk, meat and dairy together. They say there are three prohibitions because it's three times in the Torah. There's a prohibition to cook it together, which is the plain meaning of the pasuk. There's a prohibition to eat it together, which is not the plain meaning of the pasuk. And there's a prohibition to derive any benefit from its combination, meaning don't be a shareholder in a business that is selling this stuff to Jews to eat, right? Don't sell that Whopper to someone and make a profit. Don't derive benefit. Three things, because the pasuk is there three different times. Now, Rabbi Hoffman, he's a smart man. Firstly, he knows that anytime you're going to have something three times in the Torah, it's going to bug the Bible critics to no end. Right? Three different authors, different people, different this, different that. Right? But not only that, he is well-versed in the other translations of these psukim. Not just the way the Jews translate it, but he is well-versed in the way that other cultures translate it. So look at this, and I gave it to you in the English because it's a long paragraph, but it's worth checking it out. The bottom of page 3. Look at what he cites here. These are some things that some of us may never even have heard of, let alone opened up. And this man in the 19th century, a Talmud Chacham that he was also reading these other things. The bottom of page 3. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, commentary to Deuteronomy, to Devarim. The Septuagint. Septuagint is the translation of the Torah into Greek. It was done in the 4th century before the Common Era. The Gemara records that the Jews fasted when the Septuagint was created because they were very upset that the Torah was getting into other people's hands and it was liable to be falsified and corrupted and all that. But it had existed as an authoritative source in the general culture. The Vulgate, translated 8 centuries later, the 5th century Common Era by Jerome, a Christian translation into Latin. And others translate this verse literally. In other words, they say don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Doesn't say anything about dairy and meat in general. Just literally. Look at this. What a character. He continues, the Samaritan version of Exodus 23:19. The Samaritan version. What's the Samaritan Bible? I've never even heard of the Samaritan Bible. Well, Samaritans are people, you can go visit them on Mount Gerizim today. My family went to visit. We did not go when they were doing the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which they do every year. But we went and we saw their sukkah, which is made indoors. We saw the pictures of their Kohen Gadol, their high priest. They still have Kohanim Gedolim. They believe that they are the ancestors of the kingdom of Israel in the north. 10 tribes, some of them were exiled. They claim whoever was left, they're the Samaritans, and that's us. And we have a Bible from back then. Their Bible is slightly different from our Bible. Okay, their Chumash, I should say, is slightly different from our Chumash. The Samaritan version says, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Why? For one who does this as a sacrifice causes anger to the God of Jacob. The Samaritan version says it has to do with giving a korban. It's not eating milk and meat. It's giving a korban made of a kid and its mother's milk. That appears also in some versions of the Septuagint in Devarim, in Deuteronomy. However, in Aramaic translations and in Talmudic sources and almost all rabbinic interpretation, this verse refers to a prohibition against eating milk and meat together. Targum Yonatan, which is one of our Aramaic explanations of the Torah that we believe is dated to very early in our history, expands this commandment slightly in Exodus 23:19, the first place where don't cook a goat in its mother's milk comes up. My nation of Israel, you shall not cook or eat milk and meat in combination, so that I will not get angry and ruin your crops in combination. Why does it say that? The aim of this translation is to explain the connection with the first fruits. Okay, one second. Let's look at the psukim for a minute. Stick with me. I trust me, it is worth the ride, I think. Shemot Kaf Gimel Yudchet 23:18 in number on the bottom, on page 4, excuse me. On the right-hand column, we're just going to do it in English, okay? Thou shalt not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. In other words, do matzah, don't do bread. Do something that hasn't risen. Neither shall the fat of my feast remain all night until the morning. In other words, take it off of the mizbeach, take it off of the altar. The choicest first fruits, the bikurim of the land, thou shalt bring into the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk. So you tell me, when you read that, what does not seething a kid in its mother's milk have to do with? So, the Samaritans say it must have to do with the korban, because that's the context. Targum Yonatan says, well, even if it doesn't have to do with the korban, maybe it somehow has to do with the first fruits, right? Don't mix these two things, because otherwise God says, well, I'll mix all your crops and mess them up. First fruits, something agriculturally related. Shmot 34, right underneath, almost the same pasuk. Thou shalt not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. Sound familiar? Neither shall the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover be left until morning. Little different. The choicest first fruits of thy land thou shalt bring into the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk. Again, korban and bikurim. These two combinations. And lastly, in Devarim, as promised, has to do with the kosher laws. Of all clean winged things ye may eat, ye shall not eat of anything that dieth of itself. Thou may givest unto it unto the stranger that is within thy gates, that he may eat it. Or thou mayest sell it to a foreigner, for thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in its mother's milk. Seem to be two totally different perspectives on this mitzvah, right? One bikurim and korbanot, something that takes place in the temple, the other that takes place in your house. So he says, who's right? Are the Samaritans right where they say it's about sacrifice? Or are the rabbis right when they say that it's about just not eating milk and meat together? Okay. If you ask which is correct, we're back in Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the second paragraph on the left-hand side. If you ask which is correct, we must first see whether the plain meaning of Scripture before us is about forbidden foods, which relates to the sanctity of Israel, or about something else. Many commentators have explained the reason for this mitzvah as related to the first fruits, the Bikurim, right before it in Exodus. And they claim that the Torah is outlawing some idolatrous custom that was practiced during the harvest season when the Bikurim are given. In other words, maybe they used to boil a kid in the mother's milk when they were giving the harvest. Maybe there was something idolatrous about it. Maybe that's what it has to do with. Thus, Maimonides. The Rambam says something similar, not exactly that, but similar. And after him, Don Isaac Abarbanel. Also, some of the Christian scholars, Lahavdil, to distinguish. You see, he is well-read, this man. Explained thus, such as Zipsner, Rosenman, Nobel. However, there is no historical foundation for this. Ibn Ezra explained, and so Philo, that this is about cruelty to animals, cooking the goat in its mother's milk. And so Kyle and Schultz, Lahavdil, explained. However, then this commandment has no relevance to the other commandments in its context. He says, I'm going to show you why all three of these contexts are really about eating and why the rabbis were right. It's not about sacrifices, even though it may seem to be that way. It's not about an idolatrous practice that they did during the Bikurim, the first fruits, even though it seems to be like that. It's what it says in Devarim, it's about eating. The context of the verse in Devarim, the lists of kosher, non-kosher animals, and the prohibition of a nevela, an animal that was not shechted, that was not slaughtered, but died on its own, as we just read, shows that this verse includes a prohibition of eating, which has as its purpose the sanctity of Israel. And this is going to be the key. He says, don't just look at this pasuk for don't cook a kid in its mother's milk. Look at the fact that the pasuk says that it has to do with being a holy people unto God. He says that's the key. That, he says, is what is the same in the different contexts. All of them talk about being a holy people, which he says must be referring to their dietary restrictions. In the other two places, the verse is found in a different context, implying a different reason. But if we look closer at Exodus 23, the first place it comes up, even this context indicates a prohibition of consumption of eating. It's not about a korban, It's not about an idolatrous practice during Bikurim. It's about eating, like in Devarim. The group of commandments in Exodus chapters 21 and 22 include many commandments, and they end with a verse that relates to the prohibition of certain foods, which has as its aim the sanctity of Israel. Don't eat a trefa. Don't eat an animal that has a pierced lung, that has an injury. He says, if you look, don't just look at chapter 23 of Shmot. Look at what's before it. Before it, you find the end of chapter 22 of Shmot says, don't eat an animal that's sick, because you are a holy people. So what does he suggest? And we're going to do this outside. What does he suggest? He says, well, Shmot 22 ends a whole list of various mitzvot. And at the end, it says, you're a holy people. Don't eat an animal that's injured. Right? And to this day, that's what we found. That's what real treif is. Treif is an animal that's injured. You shecht it, and then you open it up, you see the lung has been pierced, and it's gone. So, right? And then he says, chapter 23 then does the same thing. A bunch of psukim, a bunch of commandments, and ends with, don't see the kid in its mother's milk. You're a holy people. That's an assumption that he makes. He says, just like in Devarim, it says, you're a holy people, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, and it's about eating. He then says, look back to Shemot, the first place where we see it, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, he says, must be serving the purpose of saying, you're a holy people, so it's about eating. Wow! Ever see anyone go like that? To scratch their ear? Right? Unbelievable. Are people see what he did? Right? It's pretty interesting. What he's trying to do is he's trying to say, look, you think you found different authorship, you think you found different explanations, different contexts. I'm going to tell you that you have to think a little bit more creatively. I'm going to tell you that it's not just whether it says in the pasuk that it's about eating or whether the context says it's about eating. I'm going to tell you there may be something else at play. Talks about not for naught does it talk about holiness at the end in Devarim. Not for naught does it talk about holiness right before in Shemot. They must all be talking about eating, holy people. That's what it has to do with. You can question many, many of his assumptions within here. You can question many of them. But what you cannot question is what he's clearly trying to do here. Right? He is trying to take the pshat, the plain meaning. He's trying to interpret it in such a way that it can be compatible. Okay? It's tough to follow, but it's worth seeing what his project is. Okay? We have to end because we're 4 minutes over already. But what I will say is, this typifies one perspective that is part of the polemic throughout the ages. Trying to use the rabbis as a springboard for commentary on the Torah, trying to look at the Torah in its plain meaning, but not necessarily restricting it to the few verses that you're looking at, but maybe taking a broader view and trying to develop a concept that both works with the pshat, the literal meaning, and works with what the rabbis have to say about it. That's approach number one, and that is an approach that has been taken over and over and over again. As I can see by people's facial expressions, it doesn't necessarily get you going, right? It's a tough thing to hold on to, because quite frankly, we are much more used to looking at the pasuk on its own. And that's why we're going to move on and try a new perspective, and we're going to come back at the end. We're going to come back, but we're going to try a new perspective that looks in a very different kind of way, and instead of trying to reconcile and say, these two are saying the same thing, it's a perspective we're going to see next week that says, no, these two are different things. Yet, they come from the same author. Instead of trying to prove that they're saying the same thing in order to prove the same authorship, we're going to look at someone who says, it's okay for one author to want to give two perspectives, two messages. That's going to be next week. If you have not yet put your name on the sheet that's coming around, I would appreciate it if you would. I'm here for questions. If anybody wants to ask, if anyone wants to leave, please feel free.
Thank you.
Please, thank you.
Is this author one author God, or is this one author Moshe Rabbeinu through God? In other words, was it multi-prophetic?
You mean according to Rav David Tzvi Hoffman?
No, according to the whole picture we're going to see, which of course is going to go towards Moshe Rabbeinu.
Right.
But even Ezra started something. Name it.
I totally agree with you. I think we do come to a sort of confusing point. Today, I think the way that we look at it more often than not is Moshe from Hashem. A lot of times in the literature that you see in the 19th century, you almost see them talking about Moshe writing the Torah, which is a very interesting, I don't know if that's polemical.
But they were fighting against
ripening.
You remember that?
Haktava Kabbalah.
They were fighting against the Breslin.
Yeah, Rabbi Melkenberg, this was a whole school. Right, right. Rav David Zvi Hoffman is much more sort of taking on the external culture. I think that's partially because he thinks it'll give more credence to what he has to say to the internal culture. But agreed, the people in his camp are fighting their fellow Jews, and they're fighting, you know, outside the next concentric circle. Yes.
Is Rabbi Sam?
Feel free if you need to walk by. Please feel free. Oh, does someone have the sheet?
For?
Oh, okay, great. So Paul's got the sheet. Oh, please, thank you. Yes.
Where
Marvin.
Does Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch come in? Didn't he also publicize about this whole issue? Was he helping the rabbi at this time? I thought he was one of the important people.
So Hirsch was not necessarily a, what can I say? He was not a linguist. He was not a, systematic writer in the sense of being able to take on the Chumash. However, he did definitely...